You know what?
I think hamburgers are delicious, but somehow you'll like them so much that I won't even be sure if I like them anymore. Listeners, and welcome to episode 66 of Bad Voltage. I hope you recovered from last show, because if you thought it was contentious last episode, you just wait until you delve into this episode. Speaking of this episode, what are we talking about, guys?
Language.
Oh, that's me first, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, you know that list of things where we read it out? You see where it says Stuart on that list?
It is me. So, yes. Hi, I'm Satoshi Nakamoto, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about, we disagree quite a lot in the last show on what activism is, and in this show, we completely fail to resolve that disagreement.
No, I am Satoshi Nakamoto, and we are going to be reviewing the Withings Aura Smart Sleep System from the future.
And then, if a chunk of activism isn't enough to hear your parents having an argument and almost divorcing, we're going to continue the discussion, kind of, where we're going to start out talking about XMPP and Google Hangouts and why images aren't supported, and then we're going to kind of, what's the word, pivot into
segue?
A bit more activism.
That's a good point, Nakamoto.
And since Satoshi Nakamoto is clearly already taken, I'll be Craig Wright. And now, Bad Voltage.
Within the demographic of people who listen to Bad Voltage and people who are interested in open source and technology and digital rights and stuff like that, activism has played a pretty heavy role in our lives, right? We're familiar with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, various activism efforts across the years, like the anti-DRM stuff from the Free Software Foundation, various other things. And of course, we hear about this all the time, that activist groups are kind of fighting the power, like Occupy Wall Street and whatever else. But the question I have is, how effective is it, right? Because I think there seems to be different types of activism. Like, you'll have protests, which is one way, but then you'll have, I would say, more elegant ways of doing activism, such as what the Electronic Frontier Foundation do. But what works, right? How, if you've got, like, the man and you want to fight the man, what have we seen that actually works? Because a lot of it seems to be just shouting in the wind, and it doesn't really get anywhere, and it's just demotivating for the people who put time into it. But some of it genuinely does actually change how things work. What do you guys think?
Well, we've seen activism, both in the technology space and the non-technology space, bring about huge, crazy, fundamental, earth-shattering changes pretty much every year since the dawn of recording anything. I mean, this is just kind of how things change. Look at the country you guys come from and the country we're in right now. It would not look at all like it is right now if it weren't for people just rising up and getting all uppity and beating stuff.
Hang on. I can certainly see that argument, but I think we're a technology show, and my inclination
I believe that we are an outdated device and music show. I'm pretty confident that's the case.
We are an outdated device and music
show. Depends on the episode, certainly.
For all of your Kindle 3 reviews. But the point is, you could look at things like the Arab Spring or the American Revolution or whatever and say they're examples of activism which got stuff done.
Yeah.
Or even Occupy Wall Street. But in practice, nobody's actually marching on the streets to ensure that the next version of the iPod Shuffle doesn't have DRM.
Oh, that's just because nerds don't like going outside. I mean, we take different routes to make noise. It's all about making noise. You make noise on the streets, you make noise in newspapers, you hop on the TV shows, you get on the radio waves, you hop on the internet, you make noise.
So I think this actually really gets to the root of the disagreement we had during the Revolve segment, right? Is that I think if you look at how I view activism, it's my mentality going into it is going to be, how can I stop this thing that I think is wrong for good, What measures can I take to stop this thing? I think, Brian, it was clear your mentality is a little bit more along the lines of how can I express my anger at this thing that I think is wrong? And maybe even segueing from there into how can I educate others to know about this thing that I think is wrong? And I think that is a little bit of where the disconnect.
How can I motivate the people that need to change in order to change? That's where it comes down to. Like whether it's the people in power or the consumers or the other companies that are interfacing with companies that are doing something wrong. How can you motivate those people to change behaviors, to change laws, to change practices for the better good? That's the goal. And sometimes it is just getting really pissed off and being so loud that you can't be ignored.
Yeah, because I think that's the crux of it is... I think a lot of it depends on what you change to Axe point. Like, look at the Arab Spring, right? I mean, that was just the thing that pops out in my head when I think about that was just those pictures, those videos of people collected together and such an overwhelming demonstration of opposition towards what was going on. And you can't really shy away from that, right? It's such a visual depiction of people coming together. But then it works for something like that where the ramifications of what was going on were pretty dire for people. I mean, people were dying, right? And that's one of the reasons why people, there was that uprising. Whereas to Axe's point about like the iPod shuffle, like people maybe doesn't have such dire like ramifications, but it does have ramifications in another way. But it seems like when we see activism there, it's just more of like people whittling on at other people about stuff. And I don't know how effective that is.
Well, part of the thing
extremely.
That is, I mean, we named a bunch of, you know, high profile, very loud, very shouty ways of pushing back against something like the American Revolution. But equally, if you look at, say, Gandhi as an example, the whole idea of passive resistance, I mean, the Indian word means firmness in the truth.
Yep.
And that wasn't loud and it wasn't shouty.
It was attention grabbing. And that's the entire point.
It totally got a lot of attention, yes.
That's the whole point.
But it's not clear to me that a lot of what we might call open source activism knows how to get attention without shouting.
To
give you an example, the thing we were talking about in the last show, about two quite different approaches to convincing Internet of Things vendors to start caring about what happens if their company dies. And one of them was you make a lot of noise and that alerts consumers to it. It creates a groundswell of public pressure on vendors to not do this. And then the second way is more kind of the appropriate quiet word. You set up a kite mark awarding consortium who give people ratings, then hope that gets picked up. But there's no shouting involved. They both seem like good approaches at one time or another.
I think you're getting hung up on the word shouting, on making noise and conflating that with shouting and just simply being angry. Making noise and being visible is the critical bit. It may be that you're angry. It may be that you're totally chill about it. It may be that you're actually laying in bed on a hunger strike, but you're making noise about it. An example, an extremely low visibility example. A couple of years ago, do you guys remember when Google updated Chrome OS and removed the ability to mount a bunch of different file systems types like ext3 and whatnot. Yeah. So Chrome OS devices basically couldn't work with most Linux devices. It was a real piece of crappy thing. The outpouring that happened, people wrote articles like myself. There was a couple other articles that were out there. People were writing into Google. People were posting on forums. They were making noise about it. Google saw it, realized that this was going to be an issue for them, responded appropriately, and re-implemented those file systems back into the OS. Now, and they did it relatively rapidly, and I have to give them kudos for that, because they noticed it. They noticed it was going to be a problem. It was going to be a marketing problem. It was going to be a problem with their core audience that helps to promote this burgeoning operating system of theirs at the time. So there's a lot of examples of that if you really dig into it, where companies respond based on what they hear, not just from their customers, but their advocates or the people that could be their advocates. And this happens all the time. Companies are listening very carefully to all this stuff. When we talk on this show about Internet of Things stuff, those companies are listening. I know for a fact they are listening. They may think we're stupid, but they are listening.
Where's Google Reader? which got at least as much noise as that.
And I'm not saying that they make good decisions all the time or do what we want them to do, but we can try to push things in the right direction. Now, after we've been out there, after we've pounded the pavement, metaphorically speaking, we've gotten articles out there, we've talked to the companies, we've talked to their competitors, we've talked to their partners, after we've made the noise, then you can start to look at, you know, pressure, if it's really important to you, applying legal pressure, applying market pressure beyond just making noise. But making noise usually works. It usually works. It works really well. In fact, it's easy to come up with examples on both sides of it working and it not working. It really is, because I mean, there's never a cut and dry, but it usually works.
I think the key thing though is structuring the feedback in a way that demonstrates that this is the viewpoint of the many. Because if you don't that, it just comes across as whining.
Well, yeah, like you don't put up the only post and say no one else in the world thinks this, just me, so ignore me. Of course not, man.
No, but the point I'm making is that, and every technology company knows, I think every company knows this, it's got customers, but you will invariably deal with shitstorms over the years, right?
There'll be
angry bloggers. There'll be people tweeting, moaning about something.
Even if you're a great company that tries really hard, something's going to go wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So there's going to be people tweeting and moaning and this, that, and the other, right? And I think the difference is that a lot of companies will basically dismiss that. They'll say, well, that's just part of doing business. There'll be some people who don't like what you're doing, and that's just the way it is. The thing in my mind is successful activism is when something gets to the point of there is like people have amassed together and they've demonstrated effectively that this is something that really does affect. This isn't just a minor PR thing. This is something that's significant, that needs attention, that needs action, that needs change. And I wonder how you do that effectively. Like, I think in many ways, bringing people together it's showing the unification, I guess, of feedback. To me, strikes me as the most important thing with activism, which you see very visually in like the Arab Spring. And we've seen in technology when you get like clumps of people, you know, representing themselves at conferences or in blog posts or in articles or whatever else. You know, that strikes me as the most effective way of doing it. Otherwise, it's just wittering.
Right? I got to say, I have no idea what point you're trying to make. Are you trying to make the point that doing a good job of communicating an idea is better than doing a bad job of communicating an idea?
I guess what I'm saying is I think activism is about the unification of people coming together to make the point. I think if you get like, let's say, for example, you have 100 different people write 100 different tweets, right?
Yeah.
That could arguably be dismissed as just wittering on the internet. Depending on like, I mean, if they all happen in a very short period of time, then maybe that's different. If you get 100 different people coming together to make the same point, I think that's more effective. And that's what we've seen with the Arab Spring. If you had like 100 protests all over the country,
wait,
right?
Is your point about the tweets? You're losing me again. So 100 people wrote 100 tweets that are on the same topic or different topics? Because
on the same.
Okay, so then they are all coming together and talking about the same topic and making the same point. Let me give you an example.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that people wanted Brian Lunduk off our show, right? And that was something that our listeners didn't like. They didn't like Brian Lunduk on the show. They want him off. Now, if we had 50 different tweets that basically said, Brian Lunduk sucks, he needs to be off the show, we'd probably dismiss that, right? We'd be like, whatever, it's just people talking shit on the internet. And that happens all the time.
Sure.
Just people randomly tweeting all over the place. Whereas if a group of people all amassed together onto the Bad Voltage forum at the same time,
right,
and they said, we the listeners don't like this. That's what I'm basically saying.
So effective communication is better than ineffective communication, because like that seems to be the point of this. So you actually agree completely with everything I've said then?
I never agree with it. The point I'm making is
very subtle spin move there.
I guess the point I'm making is that activism needs to be organized. It needs to be coordinated. And when it's not, it could be dismissed.
Well, I think we've reached a weird point too with activism, where there's a certain set of, I don't like the word, but I think you'll all know what I'm talking about, slacktivism, that I don't think is effective and can come off as a bunch of people whinging on the internet. And I think it's, easy to conflate the two, but if you have meaningful activism, I think it's very effective if done the right way. But yes, we've reached a point where it's so easy to see a meme on the internet, be like, yeah, that's a terrible thing, and everyone gets upset for a day, and then everyone forgets about it because their attention span these days is nil. So I think there's also, a slacktivism, yeah, I don't think works, and is sometimes detrimental to true activism because the lines, yes, are getting blurred.
Yes, I'll give you that.
And
sure,
that I think is something that gets quite... I mean, I entirely take Jono's point that I think 50 separate initiatives on one thing is less powerful than one where all 50 of those people come together. The whole is more than the sum of its parts. But
sure,
I think a lot of people confuse that with the idea that you can say, look, I said this thing and 10,000 people retweeted it. That's 10,000 people all coming together to make,
right,
a point. And it totally,
exactly,
isn't, because they're slacktivists.
That makes a really big point. I guarantee you, the big companies, Microsoft, Adobe, everyone, they pay attention to that. If everyone's like, you know, what the hell did you do with your new licensing, Adobe? And then 10,000 people retweet that tweet. Adobe pays attention and schedules meetings about it, and they figure out either how to squash it or fix it. I know,
yes,
I know for a fact that's how it works.
I agree, but there are, that doesn't happen in all circumstances. That happens.
Well, nothing happens in all circumstances.
Hang on.
No,
what I'm saying
thing
is that
every circumstance.
Listen, shut up. Listen, what happens, I think, is that happens so long as the people who are making the points are people the company respects, right? I think if you have a bunch of randoms on the internet who don't really have as much of an impact in the industry or whatever,
so long
else,
as they're stakeholders, they, right,
they, yeah, so if you have for example, if talking about Microsoft as an example, if you have a bunch of MVPs in the Microsoft world coming together and complaining, then that will definitely trigger those meetings. But if those people are just randoms on the internet, I don't think there will be as much of an urgency to have those meetings.
The other thing to bear in mind about this is we're working from a very skewed data set, because we can point out a whole bunch of example things where a lot of publicity or noise, or phrase it how you want, you know, large-scale public activism happened, and that changed a company's,
right,
mind or a government's mind or whatever. But you've got no idea how successful having the right person putting the right word in place is, because you don't
crazy
know whether,
yeah,
it happened. Anytime anything at all happens, that might have been a policy of let's exterminate all the puppies in the world until the right person put the right word in, and then the company changed their mind. But we don't,
again,
see it. So
but
we
again,
don't
that's
know
just communication.
How successful that is.
I mean, so if we have, all right, just I mean, in my own work over the last couple of years, I've seen many different things, like that issue with Google. It's a very small thing. Spoken up about it, made a big deal,
right,
about,
right,
it, affected quick and radical change for,
but
the better.
But I would say,
and that happens
to use your example,
a lot with
to
a lot
use your
people
exact example with the exact same company, I would say an order of magnitude more press was generated by Google Reader. But because they did not see that as a critical component moving forward, they did not care. Demonstrably,
right,
did not care.
Right.
So I think
no,
activism is not, does not come in a bubble like that. I think it's that in the case of the EXT thing with Chrome, people did care, but I think they looked at the situation, realized they probably made a mistake, and changed that because it behooved the product.
Right, because
so activism was certainly a component, but activism alone, as in the case of Reader, way more people complained, totally didn't care.
But
still,
but those are very different things. So what we're talking about here is, and the point Jono was making earlier about, if people need to be stakeholders in order to be taken seriously, but people on the other side of things also need to be stakeholders in order to have a vested interest in seeing something improve. This is a good example. Google is killing Reader. They have no vested interest in this going forward. Ergo, why do they care? They simply drop it. And unless it hit a point where it was negatively impacting their bottom line more than keeping it around, they're not going to care because it's a business decision. They were a stakeholder in seeing Chrome OS continue to evolve and grow. Therefore, they're going to try and make sure that the other people who are stakeholders in it are loving it and talking about it and happy with it. And that's a critical thing. It's just, that's how it works in government and everywhere else. That's not an unusual
thing.
That
suggests to me that if you've got a decision that a company or a government or whatever are taking, but they're not particularly invested in either side, that activism can certainly tip the balance in one direction or another. You can get them to go, oh, maybe we should reconsider that.
It's always easier. Going,
we're going to do this easier. Thing. It doesn't matter how much activism you put in. It won't help. So the question of how useful is activism really is almost a question of how important is this to the people you're activating against.
And not to keep going back to the Chrome example, but I think there's a non-zero chance that if no one would have said anything from a consumer perspective and Acer and Samsung wouldn't have liked the decision, Google would have also reversed it.
But again,
because I think from a long-term
activism.
Marketing perspective, it...
That literally is just activism. That's just a different stakeholder talking about things. That's all it is.
Expressing an opinion is not activism.
Right. No, if Acer and Samsung said in a business meeting, we don't want that, that's not activism.
No. It isn't. That is not activism. That's just disagreement.
Yes.
Activism, I would say, is it's people coming together who share a common viewpoint to affect change, right? Yep. And it's invariably... activism, you are playing the underdog in that role. And that's one of the reasons why I think a big chunk of this personally is activism is a... this sounds
activism,
somewhat trite.
The policy
but
or action of using vigorous campaigning to bring about a political or social change. Now, I think in this regard, we're also applying it to technological thing. Again,
campaigning is the thing. Yeah.
If you are Samsung and you don't like what Google's doing and you go and talk to them, you are campaigning them to do something.
You are reading that all wrong.
I mean, when I think of activism,
that is the definition of the words. I mean, if you guys want to redefine English, that's fine. But those are the definitions of the words.
I think you're redefining campaigning there.
Here we go. Yeah. Campaigning. You guys keep talking. I will look it up.
All right, here we go.
At least for me personally, when I think activism, I think kind of the Margaret Mead, right? The never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever
exists. That's what I think. Organized or active way towards a particular goal.
Right, but
done.
if it's
exactly
two people at Samsung
what I just
in
said,
the biz dev
literally
division don't like it,
T.
that's not... No.
It just, dude, you guys, no, you guys no. are adding in meaning that isn't there. I'm just sorry. That those are the words.
Well, by your definition, then everything is activism.
No, these are the words. Right. These are Merriam-Webster and everyone else. These are the words. Those are what they mean.
So you're telling me if one person at Samsung...
One person can make
emails
a difference.
Google.
Have you seen what Frodo did?
Hang on. Let me ask you this question. If one person at Samsung emails Google and says, we don't like the fact... that you're closing Google Reader down.
Yeah.
We'd prefer if you didn't do that. You're saying that that's activism.
That's technically, yes. Technically,
no,
that
no.
is activism.
Are you saying that's activism?
Yes, because it is activism. It may not be effective activism. It may be quiet right. activism. It All may right. be one okay. guy taking a muted stance. But technically, yes, that's what it is. Now, if what we're talking about is broader public campaigns that involve many right. thousands of people organized, that's an entirely different thing. But it is still, both of them are activism. Both of them are campaigning for a specific change.
I agree. I agree. Okay, and so, technically, dart players are athletes as well.
So let's our initial question then maybe shouldn't have been how useful is activism because it's too generic a term. Instead of that, we'd say what can we do? You know, members of the community who want to affect change made by some company or whatever. They're changing something technologically. We'd like them to do it differently or to not do it at all. How can we motivate them to change their opinion? And one way would certainly be to ring up your sister who is CEO of Samsung and ask them to do it. Assuming you don't have such a sister, how
That's
else can we do
right
it?
Now.
And how useful are the methods that we have available to us?
I don't think that's an answerable question, personally. I think that
it really is
so situationally dependent. If you look at a situation like SOPA, right, I think that is a good example of the tech community coming together and using activism in a very compelling way that affected clear, demonstrable change.
Yes.
I think that exact approach for many other things would not have worked. I think you have to look at the specific situation at hand and use a variety of different activism tools to create change. One of which
I think a lot of it as well. Sorry, go ahead.
One of which is building awareness. I don't know though that just building awareness, just widening people's understanding of the world, I don't know that consistently has a tangible change. I don't know but that it tangibly does in consistently. Many cases. It's the first and component often.
All I know is I've been able to use my relatively limited soapbox to affect noticeable change multiple times over the years. And I'm not alone, you don't know
whether your article was the catalyst for that change. Just because one detail plays a role in the change doesn't mean that that detail is a reason for the change.
No, but
otherwise we could draw connections to everything, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. But I mean, if we're looking around and when we're saying, okay, here's a change that we want to see happening, we have a set of X, Y, and Z that are public events or public statements by people to affect that change, and then we see the change happen, and the company even releases statements along the lines of, you know, we heard your feedback and we made change, which has happened a lot, and not just for me, but for articles over on ZDNet have caused that over the years. Like, things have happened. It happens. So there's no reason to discount it. It seems to be working. It seems to be working. Not just now, but for the entire history of humanity, this approach has worked. This is how the United Kingdom has a parliament. This is one of the many ways.
An externality you're not considering, though, is the problem. Every time we make a lot of public noise about something we, the open source community, don't like, it may help to change that thing, but it marginally degrades the appearance of the community in general because we look like whiners who do nothing but complain.
I suppose so.
Individual people shout about. If you look at the FSF's approach to DRM, which is to march up and down and shout about it the whole time, and never spend any time going, okay, what can we do about this beyond just complaining as loudly as possible? Each individual complaint is justified and probably correct, but the totality of complaints degrades the whole argument to the point where we just get dismissed as whatever. They just go on all the time. Who cares about them? You drop off the cliff into the sea of people who can be ignored forever because you do nothing but complain.
I see what you're saying. I totally do. However, your argument comes back to the same thing John was arguing earlier. Effective communication is better than ineffective communication. And part of effective communication is staying on point, staying on message, not muddying the waters, etc. And that's fine. That's totally fine. And I think we all would agree with that. But that doesn't negate in any way the efficacy of activism.
But I would say building on your point, Brian, not just the how effective the communication is and staying on point and having a good message that's easy to consume. I think a big chunk of what makes activism effective is knowing your target and knowing them well, and not just knowing how they operate. Like I think the activism and the...
Of course, that's part of effective communication. You have to know your audience.
I think what hasn't been effective for a lot of organizations is when they basically think that screaming at people and yelling and belittling is the way in which you do it. I think what a big chunk of this is, you know, as we all know, like, so much business in the world is done in bars and in restaurants and in corridors. It's not done in meeting rooms. And when people sit down and have conversations and try to build relationships and try to build change, that to me is when it's effective. The challenge is that will only, if you can never get into a room, if you can never build a relationship, at that point, the yelling and the screaming seems to be your only option. But I think a lot of people jump to the yelling and the screaming and the complaining first, as opposed to trying to build relationships and trying to build change in other ways.
So what you're saying, again, has nothing to do with activism. What you're saying is don't be a dick and be good at communicating. That's all. I'm going to be clear. So I'm listening to what you guys are saying. The points you are making are not incorrect, but with the words you guys are choosing, and I think if you go back and listen to what since we started and then taking the last episode into context, it sounds as if you are advocating against activism in general.
Now, I listened to the last show. I think anything that I said could be construed in any way, shape, or form. At least speaking for myself, I'm definitely pro-activism.
Right.
Yeah. I think, once again, we're having two completely different discussions.
I think so.
Two shows in a row.
And again, I'm going to be very clear. Everything we're talking about, like those, the words are important. Every word that I've been talking about is correct in dictionary definition, and we're just disagreeing on, I suppose, what activism is or what communication is. I don't even know what the conversation is at this point. I'm very confused, not only at what the stance is of, like, let's say Jono's stance. I don't even know. It doesn't even make any sense to me because I don't know
what the point is trying to make. That's because you're not listening to the words that I'm saying.
No, all I'm talking we've already about established
how you,
that you all, disagree all with the dictionary is, on words, but have not established what your new definitions are.
No. All I'm saying is the whole point of this discussion was, what are the effective methods of doing activism? Nobody on this discussion thinks that activism is a bad thing. What we're talking about is what's effective and what works and what doesn't work. And all I'm saying is sharing some viewpoints on methodologies that I think are effective and methodologies that I don't think are effective. That's all it is, right? This is not a question about whether activism is a good or bad thing. This is not about picking apart specific dictionary definitions. It's about what have we seen that works and what doesn't work in different ways. All I'm saying is that I think if you know your audience and you mix together, the points I've made so far are activism is more effective when you get together as a group and you have a combined voice as opposed to a disparate voice. And when you build relationships with the organization that you're trying to affect first, as opposed to yelling at first, I think that will have a more effective approach. I don't think that's a particularly controversial thing to say.
No, not a controversial thing to say, but also not the points you were making at the beginning of the segment.
I have not.
So I'm confused at what word the away is, because I don't even know what we're talking about anymore.
All right. I think we should wrap this up.
I think so. I think this that's for
the best.
Gone
off the rails.
It has indeed gone off the rails. Long-time listeners will recall I reviewed the Y-Things WS50 Smart Body Analyzer a couple years ago. As I mentioned in that review, I'm someone who makes a concerted effort to stay relatively healthy. Part of that means exercising regularly and being cognizant of my eating habits, but as an open-source tech guy, I'm someone who prefers to make empirical decisions. I like data. I like being able to spot trends and from there, see if I can find causation. A large part of staying healthy is getting enough sleep, and studies have shown that many people simply don't get enough. While I was interested in getting data about my sleep, having to wear a device to bed every night or having to remember to activate a device regularly is anathema to me. Under the Y-Things Aura smart sleep system, which aims to track your sleep without any manual interaction. The Aura consists of two pieces. A plastic bedside device that serves as a control panel, speaker, digital clock, USB port, and LED light that works in conjunction with the sleep programs and alarms, and a flat cloth sleep sensor that you place under your mattress. Once configured, the device will automatically track and measure temperature, luminosity, sound levels, heart rate, and amount of sleep. Sleep is broken into light, deep, and REM cycles, which are then combined with time awake to give you a number for total time in bed, and that number includes how long it took you to initially fall asleep. The data is sent to the same Android or iOS HealthMate app as the WS50, which then syncs the data with the online portal. In addition to sleep tracking, you can set a sleep program which combines soothing sounds with a sunset light spectrum, which is various shades of red starting from light and then going to dark. You can use a nap program which allows you to sleep for a specific duration of time, or you can set a traditional alarm. One nice alarm feature is that you can tell the app not only what time you need to get up, but also how many minutes before that you are willing to get up. It uses this data, along with the sleep tracking, to slowly start waking you using a sunrise spectrum light, which is various shades of blue going from dark to light, and then soft sounds once it detects that you're in the optimum part of your sleep cycle during that time window. You can even be woken up to a custom Spotify playlist. Once you've had the device set up and tracking for a while, the app and online dashboard start to build activity and sleep patterns. While it's easy to see how much sleep you're getting and what kind of sleep you're getting, there's unfortunately no attempt to explain why you may not be getting enough sleep or what actions you could take to try to improve your sleep. I should note that I initially had some issues with connectivity and the alarm function, but recent firmware updates seem to have addressed those. Y-Things has consistently improved the app and online control panel and has added additional functionality over time, with the most recent being Nest integration. The device retails for $299 with one sleep sensor or $369 with two sleep sensors. Roughly a week or so before this review, Y-Things was acquired by Nokia, though it's a little bit too soon to know what long-term impact that will have. So, what's the bad voltage verdict? The WiseThings Aura Smart Sleep System gives you a lot of data, and in my experience has been surprisingly accurate. The passive nature of the device appeals to me and ensures you have consistent and reliable data. While it would be nice if there was an attempt to further analyze the data and give customized actionable advice, you do have the raw data to do this yourself. Overall, the device works well, and if the concept appeals to you, it's something I'd recommend.
Interesting.
yeah. Interesting is a good way to put it. Okay.
You look like you have some thoughts, Brian.
I have some thoughts, more some idle musings and not really concerns. So this reminds me far too much of, like, when you see this and when you use it, do you think I'm in Logan's Run right now? Like, it's like this weird post-apocalyptic future type device where everything's sleek and clean and everything glows with a cool color from behind and it knows how you sleep. Time to wake up now, Jeremy. It's just a little, it's just like it crossed over that bridge into this weird 1960s sci-fi where the future looks nice, but is kind of scary as hell and you don't know why. Do you ever feel like that when you're laying in bed and you're unable to sleep and certain that someone is watching you?
So I hadn't thought of it like that, but thanks for that. I'm sure tonight I will not sleep at all.
That's what I'm here for, my friend.
So I do have a question about the beautiful sleep. The way the thing works, as Jeremy says, you've got a little kind of a flat bit which actually goes under your mattress or whatever.
Correct.
And then you've got this nice kind of shit porthole looking blue light thing, which you're Correct. Meant to use as an alarm clock and stuff and sits next to your bed.
Yeah.
But if you don't want an alarm clock next to your bed, what do you do with it? I mean, can you just put it in a drawer, at which point it still just glows blue at you from the drawer the whole time?
So if you don't want the clock on it, you can just shut the clock off. And when you fall asleep, the clock actually goes off because it knows you're sleeping, so it doesn't want any extra light in the room.
Oh, I suppose,
and the clock
yeah.
is very, very dim anyways. But yeah, no, you can set the clock off. You have to have it within, I would say, this is estimating, so don't, I'm sure it's on the box, but the sleep sensor that you put under your mattress physically connects to that porthole, as you called it. So it has to be
the
length.
Oh, there's a
wire. It has to be the length of the cable away, correct.
Oh, I assumed it was wireless. There's none of the damn pictures show the wire. There's
multiple USB ports on the back. There's three, so you can have up to two. It can monitor two people sleeping in the same bed, and then the third port will charge your phone. And it does other things too. Where, like, if you plug your phone into it, you can have it turn the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and stuff off on your phone, so it doesn't bother you and it's kind of stuff like that.
So do you need two mattress thingies for two people?
Correct.
So you'd have one for your other half and one for you.
Yes. Question.
But then they plug into the same base. Yeah.
Into the same porthole.
Question on that point. If you've only got one mattress thing, but there are two people in the bed, does it completely screw up the reading?
No.
Do you have to buy two?
You do not have to buy two.
So if you put one on one half, then it just measures you.
It completely does not measure anything on the other side. It's right. Like I said, it sounds like something that shouldn't work at all, and it works surprisingly well.
It's just one of those things where it seems like you can break this product into two areas, right? One is sleep tracking, and, you know, for duration and, you know, how many times you wake up and stuff like that. And there are other things that will do that, like the Fitbit devices will do that. Reasonably okay, right? Particularly the ones with the heart rate sensor. But then the other thing, which seems more interesting, more specific to this, is this whole, like, luminosity and music and all that kind of stuff. Are those features, like, this, putting the sleep tracking aside for 1 second, are those features actually are they good? Because...
So the way... Oh, go
ahead. I was just going to say, like, so for example, Erica and I, right? I can sleep basically in almost any conditions.
Yes.
Like, my eyes close and I'm done. Whereas, like, with her, if the window's open, she can't sleep very well because of the sounds of the birds in the morning. And if there's too much light in the room, she can't sleep as well. So I imagine this could be quite handy in those kinds of situations, depending on how people sleep.
I will say the way they draw the charts does make it pretty easy to see patterns that you maybe wouldn't have noticed around things like luminosity and sound in the room, just environmental things in general. So I think it is more useful than I would have thought at first blush. I mean, it keeping your resting heart rate, I don't know how useful that is. I mean, you can actually tell when you had a super weird dream, though, because your heart rate will spike for 2 minutes. And then, so it does definitely give you some data that I don't know how else that you would get. And if you are a soft sleeper, and I'm very much like you, so this doesn't really apply to me. I could sleep anywhere and through anything. If you are a light sleeper and didn't know why you were waking up, this could definitely tell you, oh, it was noisy, or oh, that, you know, it was lighter than you thought, or it got hot for some reason, things like that.
Right.
Now,
is that hot?
Hang on. I was going to ask.
Go ahead.
I get how a device which is under the mattress can measure the temperature of the room or the sound level of the room, and it can pick up your heart rate by, you know, feeling it beat through the mattress or whatever. How does it pick up luminosity? It's under a mattress.
Well, don't forget, some of the sensors are in the porthole, not in the sleep sensor.
Oh, right. So
the luminosity sensor, the temperature sensor.
You couldn't figure that out, Langford.
It's in the base station, yes. It's not underneath. The luminosity sensor is not in between your mattress and box spring, no.
Well, I was just thinking, I mean, that is clever. How have they done that? I can't even imagine how that would work.
Well, but because it would be physically impossible.
So the mattress thingy... It comes with a mattress thingy and a porthole. Okay. I'm not sure the Withings people that want it to be described this way. That goes between your mattress and your box spring.
What if you don't have a box spring? What if like you do like the IKEA slatted style where you just have like the slats?
So I thought a question that would be popular would be, does this work with all mattresses? And in my experience, it does, because when I got this thing a year ago or whatever, I had a traditional mattress, and I have since switched to the Lisa, which is one of those foam and a box.
Oh, yeah.
And it works with both. And one requires
but
a
box. But it goes under...
So the Lisa, you don't need a box spring, and it still works.
But it goes under your mattress, right?
Correct.
How on earth does this thing detect your resting heart rate?
So from a technical standpoint, I don't know exactly, but it is... I know my resting heart rate pretty close because I monitor it with other things, and it is within 10%.
Okay.
Shockingly close. How does that work?
Well, I mean, think about it. If you're being serious, there are documented cases of, for example, a princess being able to feel a pee through about a dozen mattresses.
Yeah, right.
And this is only one. So I don't see what your problem is.
I'm just like surprised how close it is.
So, okay, now that you are living in this Logan's Run / Ewan McGregor's The Island world,
yes.
How much better are you sleeping now? Like, do you feel like you are really sleeping better, or just sleeping with more information?
Sleeping better documented rather than sleeping better.
I think I'm sleeping in a better documented world, yes. I don't know that, because I tend to sleep pretty well, I don't know that I've gotten any actionable changes from it. If you don't sleep well, I could see some of the environmental things you might not have realized, and it would definitely point them out. The thing about me is I sleep so well that on the few nights I don't get a good night's sleep, I know I didn't get a night's sleep. It's not a question of, did I sleep well last night? I didn't, and I know I didn't. And there's probably no reason.
You wake up and start screaming at animals.
For whatever reason, you didn't.
Right. You know, I gotta give kudos to you on this, Jeremy. Not only do you sleep well, but you invest both monetarily and time in making sure that you damn well sleep well in the future with more gadgets that ensure that you sleep well. And that deserves applauding, because people need to invest in sleep more often.
I will say there's been a couple times where I was tired and had a lot of time in bed and thought I slept okay, and looked at the thing and I had a ton of light sleep and almost no deep and no REM sleep, and I wouldn't have known that, I guess.
Well, but still, it's kind of
interesting.
Right? Yeah. You mentioned the word future there. As far as I can tell, this marvelous device requires not only a proprietary Android or iOS and that's it application, but it also requires the cloud service, right?
What?
If Withings pulls the cloud service...
Or you haven't got an Android or iOS phone,
then the device is useless, correct? To hark back to a previous discussion we've had.
Without an iOS or Android device, you cannot use the device at all. It syncs directly to a device. All of the data, though, is stored on the device. So if the cloud went away, the only thing that you would lose is the portal. So it would still sync to whatever device you have. Now, one nice thing is I have it synced to my Android phone. If I look on my Android tablet, the data is there. That would obviously go away because it's all going up to the portal. But the original device you sync it on, it would still work. All of that stuff would still work.
And you can change which device you sync to pretty easily?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Once it's set up, it goes to all devices, but it only syncs to the whatever one it connects to Bluetooth first.
Okay.
So two questions there. Do you configure which devices it syncs to by talking through the cloud portal?
No. You sync it to Bluetooth first and then install the app and then add it.
So that's done with Bluetooth.
See, that's cool. Secondly, I can get behind that.
Can you get the data out of the app in order to do your own processing? I mean, you mentioned that there's not very much in the way of analytics.
This was my next question. Can you get a spreadsheet? Can you get a tab delimited file of all of your sleep data?
Can you get a tab delimited file without the cloud service?
So I've never looked in the app. If you go to the web portal, which obviously if they went away wouldn't exist, you can download a CSV. Yeah. Yes. Whether it does that in the cloud or on the app, I don't know. But I'm
fair.
But does the app have something in the way of analytics and browsing and everything, or is it literally just a pipe in between the device and the cloud?
No. You can see all the graphs and stuff natively in the app.
Right, yeah, but it may not have a way of exporting the data. So if they said, okay, we're going to kill the cloud service, it would take them presumably 15 minutes to push out an app update which had a dump as CSV.
You would think, yes.
We'll release a version of the app which does that, and then the data's all loaded.
And you can automatically have the app sync with either, what's Apple's called? Apple Fit or whatever. Cloud.
Oh, wow. HealthKit.
Yeah, it'll do HealthKit or Google Fit. So if you're exporting to either of those, you would have the data anyway and could sync to that moving forward, which is... Yeah.
That's pretty cool, then.
Yeah.
So they've done quite a good job of...
The one thing I'll say about why things in general, they don't seem to be playing any kind of really vendor lock-in game. All other things interoperate fairly well with other services. They make your data pretty easy to get in all situations. They make importing other data pretty easy in all situations. So I think they're going for a little higher end. And the one thing that's nice, like I also have the Y Things blood pressure monitor. So between the scale, the blood pressure monitor, and the sleep monitor, you get a pretty good indication of your general health, I think.
Do you have a urine monitor by any chance?
I don't, but if they made one.
Do they make one?
No.
Do you have a digital tea strainer that you pee through for kidney stones to come out of and
tells
you
the tea strainer.
You know the sick, scary, macabre reality of all of this is I'm gonna be the first one out of the four of us to die and you three are all very unfit.
Dude, me and Stuart are going to live for friggin' ever. It's fantastic.
You're going to be now that guy who used to go jogging all the time that Bill Hicks went on.
Brian eats two lunches and Stuart likes crisps and I'll die of diabetes.
To Stuart's point, Bill Hicks isn't exactly alive anymore either.
he makes a point, yes.
I have a question that I think is in the heads of all of our listeners, at least one of our listeners, well, one of our presenters.
two of our presenters, because I don't know what the question is.
The question is, and I know you've done this, so don't deny it, Garcia, right?
But at some point, for this.
You can almost see the question with your, coming in slow-mo.
Did you, you must have got jiggy with your lady on this mattress, right? What's the impact of the data? Like,
exactly.
I mean, you don't need to share duration because we know that's not going to be very long, but,
it is exactly what you think it would be.
What happens? I mean, I'm assuming the heart rate thing kind of either doesn't get detection because there's two of you rolling around on the thing or it like, what happens when the two of you...
There's more noise and the temperature goes up as you would imagine in both cases.
Tactfully answered, thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so you have tested it then.
I was expecting to say, well, my heart rate only went up to 75 because my stomach is chill, bro. There it is.
I have a newfound appreciation for A/B testing, I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
But in general. Did you look at other things which do this? I know there's a whole bunch of mobile apps which purport to do this, but they're not specially designed sensors. Or equally, they're not $369.
This is the only one I saw that you didn't need. Like I said, the odds of me wearing a device to bed every night are nil. I know myself well enough to know I just won't do it. So this is the only device that I saw that was 100% passive. You install it once and it just works every time.
And presumably you just put it there once and then you leave it. You don't have to fiddle about with it and move it around from night to night or anything.
The only time I've touched it since I bought it is when I switched from the old mattress to the new one.
Interesting.
So it's just a good implementation then from the sound of it.
The funny thing is if you read reviews online, at the beginning they had a ton of problems. The Bluetooth just didn't work. The thing would lose connectivity. It just would never sync. I bought it about a year after it came out and it still had some issues. The last firmware update they pushed seems to fix pretty much all the issues that I had and pretty much all the issues I heard about. So it's definitely a product that in the beginning, quite honestly, just wasn't very good. I think they kind of rushed it to market and now they seem to have ironed out pretty much all the bugs and it's definitely a much better product now.
That's How much time between them releasing it and it being good?
I would say for the first full year, they had quite a few problems. It was Apple. Right, it was so Apple only for about the first year. Like people couldn't even install it. Their return rates were very high. And even when I got it, the one time the alarm just didn't go off, which for an alarm clock is you can't have that happen. And they,
so they got things fixed up a lot quicker than say like Unity or anything like that, right? So, I mean, that's pretty good.
I was going to say, we've gone for at least 10 minutes without a canonical hate reference.
You know, here's the thing, though. I saw your face. You're like, you know what? Brian's going to make this reference because he's so totally right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay. That sentence was almost correct, apart from the word right should have been the word predictable.
And also, also, when it comes out of Brian's mouth, it's rarely right. So,
oh, really?
We should. I am the only person who's right in this show, and you know that one too.
That's right. That was the rules. Yes, John.
That was the rules. The rules.
No, I have to say, Jerry's point about withings or wythings, I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce it.
It's wythings because they're built on Wi-Fi. That's what the WI is after Wi-Fi.
Wythings.
Yeah. Easy way to remember.
Wythings.
Yeah. Wythings. Okay, that makes sense.
But they do seem to do both build things well and aim for a slightly higher end market, as you say. But they've also paired to a bunch of stuff that other people aren't. Like they make a smart-ish watch, which is an analog watch.
Yes.
But it's also got all the heart rate monitoring stuff in it. And when you go to a new time zone, it kind of resets itself and actually moves the hands around because it's a proper analog watch, which seems like a really interesting idea. As far as I can tell, nobody else does that.
They do seem to take a slightly different approach to a lot of things. A lot of
which I think is really cool.
None of this matters because they've been acquired by Nokia. So this time next year, they weren't existing.
Goodbye to them.
I'm joking. Nokia do pretty good stuff, but we should wrap this up. This interesting thing. I'm kind of tempted to get one of these things, actually. So thank you for the review, Mr. Garcia. Pretty good.
Jeremy and I were having a discussion on Google Hangouts. I can't remember what it was about. And I sent him an image. I was quite pleased to see that you can just paste images into Google Hangouts, the text chat, and it sends them over to the other person. And that was great. And then I got no response from Jeremy, and I was terribly insulted by his ignoring my extremely amusing picture that I'd sent of whatever it was. And then after a certain amount of discussion, it turned out that Jeremy's not using the Google Hangouts client in the browser. He's using a standard XMPP client. I'm not sure which one. Pigeon, I think.
Pigeon, yep.
Yeah, Pigeon. And what's interesting about it is that the Hangouts people have implemented the image stuff in some kind of Google proprietary way. There's a way of doing this in XMPP, and they haven't used it. So you can still use an XMPP, a Jabber client, to talk to people on Google Hangouts, but the images are done in some kind of different way. The thing I think is interesting about this is, if you're the Pigeon project, you've got two choices there. You can either cave in, reverse engineer the Google thing and re-implement it, which means that all your users actually get access to be able to do this, or you can stand strong for open source and refuse to do it. At which point, you're taking a principled stand, but Jeremy can't see images. And it's a hard question to decide on what...
This is the age-old question, right?
It's hard to decide what they should... actually do, obviously, you know. And there's it is an age-old question in that we've been the open source community have been talking about this kind of thing for years, and ideally the pigeon people wouldn't be put in the invidious position of having to choose, because Google would have just done it the Jabber way and then everything works rather than inventing their own one. But so I mean, I'm not particularly interested in what should pigeon do specifically, but how should we deal with this kind of situation? Should we in general just cave in as a policy? Should we in general stand tough as a policy? So does it make a difference if you're Debian user or a Fedora user?
It is an interesting question. I'm going to take a step back. Jeremy, I want to hear Jeremy's idea of this.
So it, once again, I think it really matters on the specific situation you're talking about. I think when Firefox used to have enough of a market share that it mattered, them taking a principal stand was always the correct thing to do, right? Because open protocols and open standards matter much more than people realize. And if you are in a position to do so, you should always take a stand. The odds of Pigeon taking a stand and then Google changing their mind seems low enough that it leaves it in a little bit of a different area. So I think what Pigeon did actually is the right thing to do. Because I couldn't see your images. The funny thing, when I opened Hangouts on my phone, I immediately saw the image. So it was just in Pigeon, it sent this weird photo, Google Plus photo link that just said you do not have permission to view this album. So after researching a little bit, I like Pigeon's answer. The official XMPP protocol is supported in the client, but because they have support for any third-party implementation into LibPurple, someone wrote a replacement Hangout for Hangouts, and if you add that to LibPurple, it just works. So I kind of like that answer. Pigeon has taken the stance that they're going to support open protocols officially in the base client. And if someone wants to write a third-party one because it's open source, go have at it.
Yeah, I like that approach as well, because certainly many open source projects generally have the policy of like, no, we want to stick to open standards. But having it modular enough where somebody else can go and create an alternative, you know, plugin or backend or whatever, seems reasonable to me. I mean, and we're so used to this in open source many years, particularly on the Linux desktop side of things, like it sucks, right? I mean, it sucks that you get kind of like wonky half working stuff and it causes a lack of confidence in some ways, in particularly in communication protocols, because you're just not sure if that thing has worked. Like if it doesn't show pictures, well, what else doesn't it show?
And we also have a terrible, terrible habit of, instead of giving people the thing they want, what they get is a little lecture about how they shouldn't have wanted it in the first place.
Yeah.
Which is not particularly... I mean, but taking Jeremy's point about Mozilla, right? When they used to have the ability to move the industry because they were one of the biggest players. But by the time the DRM thing rolled around, they took a stand, nobody cared. And so they stopped taking the stand, because what's the point? They're burning themselves in effigy for no real benefit, because the industry had already decided DRM for movies in the web was going to happen.
Right.
But how much of Mozilla's decline over the last 10 years, from being a player who can move the industry to being a player who cannot, is because they spent all their time wedded to open standards?
No, their decline was just that Firefox got too slow. I'm just going to hand wave that one off to the side.
I'd like to think slightly more nuanced than that.
That's why I stopped using Firefox, it just got too slow. You know, this is interesting, and you guys are going to kind of hate me for this, but I think this kind of comes back to the activism discussion, and hold on.
I'm so unsurprised about that I'm shocked it took 5 minutes into this segment for that to come up.
I think we should do an experiment here. I think we should do an experiment here, because honestly, I'm with you guys. I don't see Google changing to utilize open standard XMPP's approach for images with inside their Hangouts implementation. I don't see them doing it. I'm going to try and make them do it. So here's what we'll do. Here's what I can do. I'll write an article around this, and I'll try and start I'll talk around to a couple of key people and try and get some more discussion going around this, both publicly and privately with Pigeon, Google, etc. And let's see if we can get it to the point where Google will provide an open standards way for the Pigeon and LibPurple team to utilize, through open standards, images with interact with Google Hangouts. Let's see if we can, through activism, affect that change. Then let's just see if it'll work. I think there's a chance that it will. I think that,
but that
this
already
is a highly
exists
unlikely
somebody
item.
Did it.
No. Not through providing a plugin for libportable or Pigeon to interact with a non-open system, but let's literally see if Google's willing to change the way Hangouts fundamentally operates or can operate
so
to provide.
Your goal is to get Google to stop using proprietary extensions to XMPP
yes.
and the default
yes.
Hangouts client.
Well, okay. Bear with me here.
Exactly.
Jeremy, when you get the image, instead of getting the image, you get a Google Photos link, right?
Correct.
I don't think that's Pigeon doing that. That sounds
that's
to me
Google.
Like the,
yeah.
that sounds to me like the Google Hangouts team have attempted to provide some kind of a fallback. We're not going to send
it's
you
just
the
not
image
working.
Over the XMPP.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing broken. Because I get the air, you don't have permissions to view this album somewhere in their proprietary extension of the protocol. Because I was in the Hangout and you're logged into a Google account, it will know that you requested the picture and then I can see it or something. But Pigeon doesn't have access. That's what I'm guessing.
Exactly, I don't know, but then maybe so that's the target. I'd be okay with Google going, right, we're not going to start doing this the XMPP way, we're doing it our way, but we're going to send you that link, but that link will work.
Yes.
Right, that to me seems like a nice, small, focused target for Brian's articles to go after fixing.
Yeah.
This seems like an interesting test case to me.
Yeah, no, I'll provide them with a couple of options that would provide them with easy outs to provide what they need in an open standards-y kind of way, and let's just see how effective it can be. My guess is it has a shot. Will it work?
And then
I don't
know. Doesn't work, Brian admits that we were all right and he was wrong, so that's good.
Oh man!
Well, I think it comes back to
wait a minute.
I think it depends on what Google thinks of the overall problems faced. And a lot of I think the one thing that was taken out of the other segment for a variety of reasons is nuance, and it's a very nuanced discussion. And I think because we started being a little pedantic, the overall conversation got a little bit muddied. But I think this is a very interesting case to see how Brian will take the activism approach and what impact it will then have. I think it is an interesting way to look at the overall space and
let's
in a real world setting.
Yeah. And let's try it out. And next episode or the episode after, depending on how quickly we can get, you know, some sort of a response from Google, let's revisit it. Let's see how it went.
Yeah, and I think interestingly, Jeremy's point on this is absolutely right. That the Pigeon team have gone, we're not going to do that, right? We're taking a strong stand in favor of this stuff. But importantly, we're not going to stomp on other people who want to do it. Whereas if you look at something like the stuff around GCC being able to plug into external debuggers and so on, which LLVM can do, and people wanted GCC to do it, and well, I was going to say the FSF, but it might have just been Storm, and I'm not sure. It was like, no, we don't want to do that because it allows people to plug in proprietary tools. And he said, if people write it, I don't care. It's not going in. You can't have it. So that's taking a much stronger stand against it. Not only saying, we're not going to make this happen, but we're going to try and prevent you from doing it too, even if you want it because you're wrong to want it.
Yeah, I think that's like the big difference between projects that define themselves. Like, I think there's projects that define themselves by a very defined set of ethics, and there's projects that define themselves by our top priority here is to deliver great software. And obviously with a lot of, well, certainly with a bunch of the GNU projects and with some Free Software Foundation stuff, like a core part of what they do, arguably the core part of what they do, is fostering a philosophy. So if you compromise on that thing, you're compromising on the very thing that defines what the organization is. Whereas for so many, particularly these days with open source, I think people are just way more pragmatic. They're like, you know what? Yeah, that'd be cool. And it seems like Pigeon have defined like an interesting middle ground where they're going to say, look, officially, we want to have this, but we're also open to the idea of people doing other things as well, which to me seems like a really nice balance, you know?
So a quick question, because I have no idea about this. You're the web standards guy, Eck. Does XMPP have a sane way with a workflow usable to average non-technical people for sending photos?
Yeah, I have done some looking into this, but it's a bit difficult to tell. XMPP itself, the core protocol, is quite simple, but there are a million billion extensions documented as Jabber extension protocols, right?
Okay.
And some of them are little more than just someone's written up a very hopeful spec in the hope that angels fly in the window and build it for them. Some of them are extremely well documented and well implemented in many clients' ways of doing things. But it's not like there's the Jabber way to do photos. There are a bunch of different things. And then a lot of this stuff kind of comes about through consensus. As an example, before all the WebRTC stuff got developed, there was a whole bunch of video and audio transport over Jabber things, exactly to provide the kind of Jitsi Talkie.io world that was being hoped for, so we could do. So the idea, again, from the Jabber people is that Jabber is the underlying protocol under all sorts of communication, and that everything just sort of sits on top of it. Okay. And that was called, part of that was called Jingle. The Google people were involved in doing that. They wanted the initial versions of Hangouts to use it. Didn't work out. But it's not clear to me whether there is a completely standard way of shipping images and every XMPP client does it, but the Google people don't. And
so the reason I ask that is that I think from an activism perspective, it is different to go to Google and say, hey, this open protocol existed, why didn't you use it, versus this didn't exist and they did something.
Yeah.
Those are two very different things.
Yeah. The Google people, as far as I can tell, the Google Hangouts people are prepared to continue being an XMPP server as long as it doesn't impact them in any way. But when stuff starts to get in the way, they just turn it off. They disabled server-to-server federation.
Oh, wow.
Three or four years ago. Yeah. The fact that client-to-server still works, that you can use a stock XMPP client and talk to people on Hangouts, has got to, at this point, be considered a historical accident.
What happens if Brian uses activism to get them to try to use a more standardized way to share photos, and they just shut it off, and then I can't use Pigeon at all?
That they might do that, at which point we will then point to Brian and say, you see, you got it wrong, except you won't be able to because you can't talk to him because no Hangouts for you.
Let's give it a try.
It will be an interesting experiment.
No, I think this is an interesting experiment to come out of this, if nothing else.
I think it'll be fun. I'm curious to see what the timelines will be, because arguably, I mean, Google's a big company. It could take a while for them.
Right?
If they decide that they want to be receptive to the activism, they may
still
take a
month or two of internal meetings to decide how they want to message it. So you never know.
Right.
Yep. I'll
tell you what, though. Much as I would love this for the Pigeon people, if Lunduke succeeds, I'm not sure we will ever recover from the smugness all into Bad Voltage.
And here's the problem. Even when it comes to something as simple as writing a stupid poem, Lunduke never loses. Thank God this show is over, guys. Oh my God. Next episode, I was thinking we talk about My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, and I don't know, like hamburgers. Like, do we all like hamburgers?
Care Bear Stare.
Does everyone in here like hamburgers? Can we just talk about that? I think that's just going to be
You know what?
The best.
I think hamburgers are delicious, but somehow you'll like them so much that I won't even be sure if I like them anymore.
Also, technically, there isn't ham in hamburgers.
I will need a definition of a hamburger before I can answer that question.
Good,
yeah, so it's
a picture in your definition.
One of the joys of doing Bad Voltage, I think, is that we often disagree on stuff, and that's cool. And that's one of the people, like Brian was telling us in between segments, that, you know, he had some feedback at a conference, and people say, like, we enjoy it when you guys kind of row with each other. But what I enjoy is the sheer level of pedantry that we are all guilty of.
I know it.
It's kind of ridiculous.
Oh, we potentially reach peak pedantry in that segment, I would say.
Excuse me, I should point out it's not pedantry, it's pedanticism.
Nah, I'm pretty sure you got that one wrong, too. After the show, I'm going to look it up, let's do a segment next episode. Yeah,
you're being pedantic about it now, that's no good. But yeah.
Oh!
It's always fun, though. Yeah, we've had a fun few shows, I think. I mean, it's going to be... I'm dead curious to see what the listeners think about this, because we so vehemently disagree with each other on some elements.
And it should be pointed out...
Go on, fight for my side.
It should be pointed out that we're not even 100% sure why we disagree at this exact moment. No. But we're pretty confident that we damn well do.
I think I'm pretty sure that we agree.
Can you
vehemently agree?
Though, pretty sure. Are you completely
I'm not positive,
I'll be sure?
Not positive. No. Not positive at all.
I mean, either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always the fun.
Once again, put my fighting trousers on before next show. So this is going to become a regular thing. It's from the sound.
And just Jay, the gentleman rhymer.
I would like to just
do your tweet, sir.
A really quick shout out. So I was up at Linux Fest Northwest last weekend. Great show, yada, yada, yada. But the people that came up to me to talk about Bad Voltage and how much they like it were the coolest people. It was so fantastic. Like, not one person came up to me with like pus drooling out of their ear and was like, I like Bad Voltage. Like, it was all really cool people that I would be seen in public with and would high five with great regularity. And I thought that was rad. Anyway, I just wanted to say awesome to all of you guys that came out and the 20 some odd guys and the like two ladies that listened to the show. It was just fantastic.
Has that actual thing happened to you while you were participating in a previous show? That was just a very specific reference.
You know, this story is rather long and lengthy. I feel like it's a full segment. If you guys ever run out of segment ideas in some future episode, we can talk about that story. So
we will never, ever, ever, ever be that short of segment.
It really puts me into a weird place. So yeah, let's put that one off for a while.
On a slightly similar note, remember I said about the Foss Talk thing going on in London? It's sold out now, apparently, which is pretty cool.
Oh, rad. All because
I'm assuming,
of you being
I'm
there.
Everyone's going in order to see the Linux Voice team or the Ubuntu podcast and not me.
No.
But nonetheless, it is sold out. But
it's the Langrigettes. Nice. They're all there supporting their man.
No, you know why it's sold out? It's because of Dave Mega Slippers. That's why it's sold out.
I'm sure it is. People going to see Dave.
Mega Slippers in the shizzle.
It almost can't not be because of Dave Mega Slippers.
Right? I wonder, out of curiosity, if anyone's listening and has decided that they're not going to go to that event just because of Dave Mega Slippers, I would like to hear about that.
We will all chip in and buy you a Mega Slipper.
I suspect that a whole bunch of people are, in fact, going to see Dave. So, there you go.
Dave, I know Dave's listened to the show, and we were joking around about the fact that his name is Dave Mega Slippers, and he, as expected, took it in great jest and good faith and all the rest of it. I would like to ask Dave, if he's listening, which he is probably listening right now, to take a picture of his slippers and post them to the Bad Voltage forum. Because I'd like to see precisely what these slippers look like.
Yeah, how mega are they?
Because I suspect that then Dave Mega Slippers may not actually own any slippers. And this may mean he's going to go onto amazon.co.uk and go and buy the most ridiculous pair of slippers
actually
possible.
Doesn't even own slippers.
I love the idea that we could have, through a podcast, goaded and peer pressured someone into buying ridiculous slippers off of Amazon. That is a fantastic thing.
You know what that is? That's slipper activism right there up at the shop.
Slacktivism.
Slacktivism. Slipptivism.
Although, based on something Brian said, I know we're running out of time, I would like to end this with a request then. The ratio of female to male should not be what you said that it was.
It was pretty extreme. Yeah. So it was literally
everyone,
there was
all
two
listeners,
ladies.
Do me a favor, regardless of you yourself are male or female, tell one person that's a female that you think would like the show about the show so that we can try to get some parity.
Did
here.
You say tell one person that's the female? I think
a female.
I thought you said the female, which I think is funny because that might be part of the reason.
I mean, you can tell multiple females, but I'm trying to just set a realistic...
No, I agree with Jeremy. It is...
It's ridiculous.
This is a bit of a sausage party. We could do with like having a much more diverse audience. So not just women, but also people of color and all the rest of it. So yeah, let's go and get people to come and listen to the show who are not white men who are obsessed with activism.
We should start like a Google Plus group that's just like Women for Bad Voltage or something like that and see how many people we can get onto it.
I suspect that's going
to
back.
Yeah, I suspect so too.
I expect we might want to talk to people who actually know about this stuff to say, how do we best improve this? Because that's not the way.
We can talk to Scales Diversity Officer.
I bet it is going to be less than a week before this shows up on that little wiki page of yours, Jono. I give it 1 week, yeah. And that's it.
All right, let's wrap this up. We've talked for long enough.